Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 309 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Two of my lucky numbers, 3 and 9. Cannot wait for this show tonight. Our guest this evening is the amazing researcher, Catherine Chilgen. We will be talking about Shakespeare Suppressed. There are quite a few people out there that may or may not know it, but there is a controversy in regards to the great bard, as to whether or not all of the works attributed to William Shakespeare are William Shakespeare's. And my friends, this theory, I'm not even going to go as far as to say conspiracy, because this theory has been alive and well for a long, long time. So long, in fact, that it is rumored that what is at the bottom of the money pit on Oak Island that we talk about all the time on here, you know, Curse of Oak Island, things like that. Like, that is one of the things rumored to be in the money pit, is possibly additional works from William Shakespeare. So, like, that's how far the Shakespeare controversy goes. That is how far some of this topic goes. And our guest this evening is not only the head over at ShakespeareSuppressed.com. She is also a member of ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org, as well as head of the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition. You can find that at DoubtAboutWill.org. And like I said, these are not random people that put these organizations together. These are active scholars. These are actively people who are like English majors in college, professors, all kinds of stuff. It is far, far, far from the fringe, folks. It's just not in the spotlight. That's all. So after we get back from our message from our sponsor, the amazing podcast Cadet, we will be talking with Catherine Chilgen about Shakespeare Suppressed, right after this.
Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com.
That's right, folks. Stop on. Ooh, there it is again. How about that? So stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. Full disclosure, I am one of the owners at Podcast Cadet. And the whole reason I helped start that program with people was because, as a former broadcast technician, as an AV technician, I just found so many people getting really, really, really bad advice on how to start a podcast, what to do with a podcast, how do I brand my podcast, things like that. So I brought my world to production, both on broadcast as a producer as well as in the live high-end corporate AV world and years of rock and roll, together with marketers who I've met over the years, people like that. And we came up with this system where we one-on-one consult people. So if that's what you're looking for, stop on by podcastcadet.com today. Dudes20 is the code. Please do not forget while you're online to stop on by dudesandbeer.com, especially dudesandbeer.com/app. The app is live again, folks. We now have an all-new Dudes and Beer app right in your pocket. This episode is live streamed right there on there. Knowledge Vault, all kinds of good stuff. It's free right now on the Dudes and Beer website. It's the only place you can get it. It is not even available on an app market. We are working on the code right now for Apple devices, but Android, go after it, man. Right there, dudesandbeer.com/app is where you can download that. It is also in our widget area of the website. All you have to do is click the image. It'll pop up a little file. You say save. Once it hits your downloads, you click it. It'll ask you if you want to install. You say yes. Say yes to all of it, and then it'll install. Chat rooms, all kinds of good stuff. Even questions. There is a specific chat room for questions with guests, like our good guest this evening, Catherine Children. How are you doing today, Catherine?
I'm doing well. Thank you for letting me on today.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. Like I told you in our pre-conversation, this is a topic that has been near and dear to my heart since I first heard about it. And I want to say it may have been on, of course, Coast to Coast AM many, many years ago that I heard about it. But I have followed this topic on and off for years and years. Anytime I find someone who is like I found a couple people that did their doctoral but their graduating thesis on Shakespeare. And it would always be one of those like, well, you know, you sure you're covering one of those works that is actually by William Shakespeare? So,
yeah.
Let's start getting into this, because like I said in the show intro, the work of the people at ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org, at Shakespeare Suppressed, as well as DoubtAboutWill.org, for the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition. You guys are not just like a bunch of disgruntled theater students, right? That would rather put on Rent than Midsummer Night's Dream.
No, we are people who love and appreciate Shakespeare, and just over the years just became dissatisfied with what the usual story is about him. That he came from humble origins, that he had very little education, and then suddenly he just burst on the scene of the London theaters as a great writer.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of not logical when you look at the period. And so people who dig into this, it starts to get addicting, and you see that there's many, many problems with the idea that the great author was a person who was born in Stratford-on-Avon. There's a huge disconnect.
And that's just it. He was more than likely far from a country bumpkin.
Right.
He would have definitely had some, especially to write as much about ruling families as he wrote, and some of the details that he put in, things like that, that would have been definitely details that would have been more known to nobility or people in that strata of society at the time.
Yes, an excellent example of that is in Hamlet. The prime minister, his name is Polonius. For years, historians have seen him as actually a lampooning of Queen Elizabeth I's prime minister, who was William Cecil, Lord Burleigh. He was, outside of the Queen, he was the most powerful man in England. So, number one, how would this man with humble origins and no connection to the court or the Queen, how would he, number one, know him enough to parody him? And number two, how did he get away with doing that and not be prosecuted? I mean, this was not an open era where you could say whatever you wanted.
Yeah, precisely. There was no First Amendment,
nope.
which was made, our audience is well aware, we talk about it regularly, made specifically so that you could lampoon the king.
Exactly.
Made specifically so that you could write, you know, political pieces, satire, that kind of thing about the ruling class that's in.
It's necessary for a free society.
Absolutely.
So, but it was not a free society. And we have examples of many playwrights who were imprisoned back then, like Ben Jonson and George Chapman, Thomas Nash. I mean, in Nash's case, his life was pretty much ruined at that point. And this is from what they wrote. So it was a very sensitive time frame. And we have to take that in mind when we're talking about Shakespeare.
Yes.
How did he get away with this?
Yeah, precisely, because like you said, it was a volatile time in British history at the time. So
if you wrote something against the court, they could like cut your hand off, which happened to one man named Stubbs. He criticized the Queen's proposed marriage to a Frenchman, and that's what happened to him.
Now, I have to ask, named Stubbs prior or after the kettle? God, I'm a horrible
prior.
Human being, Catherine. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But let's start getting into really cracking the nut of this case to begin with and start digging into Shakespeare and who these other works may be attributed to.
Yes, well, if you just look at what we don't know about Shakespeare, that raises the question of who he was. And the problems are, for example, no evidence of schooling. We don't have anything in his handwriting, a manuscript meaning. We don't have any payments to him as a writer. We don't have any personal information written about him while he was alive.
And this is Shakespeare.
And when he died, nobody made any tribute to him. So all of these, like, zeros, he was really like an invisible man.
Wow.
So that lends itself to the idea that William Shakespeare was actually someone's pen name. But the problem is there was somebody who was born with this name, William Shakespeare, and he was the guy from Stratford-on-Avon who we today think wrote the great works.
Okay.
So we have to try and separate those two so we can have a better understanding of who the great author was. And this is exactly what a man named J. Thomas Looney, he was dissatisfied with the traditional story. And in 1920, he wrote a book called Shakespeare Identified. And what he did was he examined the plays and he made a list of characteristics of the great author, what he had to have known, and who he had to have been. And so it was like a detective would do.
Yeah, reverse engineering.
And this list of characteristics, after he compiled it, then he looked at the first thing that Shakespeare wrote, was printed, called a poem called Venus and Adonis, and it had a certain rhyme scheme. So he looked in an anthology of Elizabethan writers for that same rhyme scheme. Mm. And there were only two people who wrote that way. One was anonymous, and the other one was the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere.
Interesting.
And so he looked into the life of Edward de Vere, and wouldn't you know it, every single of those characteristics that he wrote were applicable to the Earl of Oxford. Explainable. And so really, his book was the greatest Shakespeare discovery that ever happened, but nobody knows about it to this day. It's been 100 years.
That is phenomenal to know that this concept and this research goes back 100 years.
That is even further.
That's phenomenal.
It really started in the 1850s.
Well, yeah, I just had up on screen a second ago the list of doubters from doubtaboutwill.org, and we're talking about people like these are not nobodies, folks. Mark Twain, Orson Welles, William James, Henry James, Tyrone Guthrie, Sigmund Freud, one of my favorite people in the world, Lord Palmerston, Walt Whitman, Charlie Chaplin, Clifton Fadiman, like an incredible, and it goes on and on, an incredible list of people. And like you said, especially in that Elizabethan time, that was a time of high pomp, high circumstance. To know that somebody who was supposedly the quilled pen of the royals, you know, the favorite son, like one of these people that was commissioned by royal families supposedly to write works of art, to know that he died with no fanfare. That would not have been the case. He would have been given an almost royal outgoing if that was the case.
He would. And we know the Queen saw a few of his plays, like Merry Wives of Windsor. Mm. You know, this was listed on the title pages that he actually saw.
Yeah, because there was a royal box at the O.
And we have no known dialogue between them.
Wow.
And yet, for example, another playwright of the period who wrote for her, John Lilly, we have correspondence between them, but none between the great Shakespeare.
Well, and like you said, no receipts. Like,
correct.
If there was money coming out of a coffer to go to, so you can be darn tootin' that anybody of royal decree or anybody of means that was a patron of an artist, be it Da Vinci, even. Those people kept detailed records of what they gave to folks, because the last thing you wanted to do was for the world to not know that you sponsored them. Like that's clout for your family later, you know? So to not make record of the fact that you sent thousands of dollars to William Shakespeare to commission these works on behalf of the crown, that would have just not happened.
Well, and that's a very good point, because these works really were originally made for the Queen and her court.
Yeah.
And that's something that they don't want to, you know, the professors today don't acknowledge. Like, for example, we have a record that the Queen saw a play in 1577 called A History of Error. Well, that corresponds very easily to Shakespeare's play, The Comedy of Errors. But if you ask the professor, that was written around 1592, not 1577. So that court play could not be the same play. You see, they have to discount things like that, because the Stratford man at that point was maybe, 13 years old. So it couldn't be the Stratford man, right?
Sure.
So they base their whole timeline and their research on the Stratford man's birth and death dates, right? That's how they construct their information about Shakespeare, but it's the wrong model.
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. I don't think that at least the construction of the character of William Shakespeare that we have from history would not be a forensic case. It would not be a forensic reconstruction of a character. It would be a caricature, maybe, but it would not be a forensic reconstruction. Well, like you said, otherwise we would have documentation.
We have nothing.
We would have birth registries, familial lines, things like that. There would be some sort of will going from William Shakespeare saying, like, and the library of my works goes to.
Exactly. That's another wonderful point. There's nothing in the Stratford man's will that suggests he was a writer. There's not theater play shares. There's not unpublished manuscripts. The time when he died, there were about 20 plays that had not been printed yet.
Precisely.
So, Nothing suggests that he was a writer in his will. That's just another anomaly.
Which, you know, like you're saying, nothing appears that way in his will, at least the will of the man we know as William Shakespeare historically, correct?
Yes. And the point is, there's no lifetime evidence. While he was alive, there's no evidence that connects him to education or writing. Absolutely none.
Wow.
What we have are his christenings and his children's christenings. We have his... We have various lawsuits and him owing taxes. You know, that's the type of thing that we have. Now, the one thing that does suggest theater involvement is the fact that he was he owned shares in two different theaters, one of them the Globe.
Okay.
And he was a member of an acting company, his name. So those two things for sure in his lifetime he was involved with. But that doesn't mean he was a writer, you see?
No.
But
no.
That seems to have been enough for, you know, Shakespeare scholars over the centuries to think that this was the same guy. But all you need to do is just dig a little further and you'll see there's problems.
Yeah, he may have been like me and just been like a theater tech pulling the curtain, you know?
There you go. Yeah, but where did he get his superlative education?
Yes.
You know?
Well,
he knew Greek. He knew French, Italian. He knew European geography. He knew the Bible. He knew medicine, medical terms. Over 600 medical references. And you mentioned Mark Twain. The reason he got into it was because he couldn't believe the amount of law that Shakespeare knew. He had to have been, a lawyer. Not a lawyer, but studied law. So, I mean, these are things that do not occur at the local grammar school.
Yeah.
Which is the story they want us to believe. He just somehow acquired all this education from, you know, a small grammar school.
Well, and but like I said, the intimate knowledge of the inner workings of royal families of other countries, you know?
Yes.
Which would have taken somebody in the world of politic. It would have taken somebody within royal circles to have that kind of down low at the time. The common person couldn't even, like, read a wanted poster on the wall.
Right.
Much
true.
Less a typical playbill at the Globe.
Yes.
So to think about the fact that, like, an atypical person in the time of William Shakespeare and the time of the Globe Theater and the writing of these plays, somebody just walking around with a wheelbarrow full of hay had intimate knowledge about the ruling class of Danes is a little ridiculous. That's a little comical to think.
And his knowledge on so many subjects means that he had to have access to a library.
Exactly.
And they didn't have public libraries.
And be able to read.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a big one, is being able to read and write.
Yes, yes. And there was no, teacher who said, I was his tutor. Or, you know, I noticed that he really was a genius, and I got him into a school. Or I mean, nobody claimed that for
and
him,
you
to
know,
help him.
That's interesting, because that's a very, very good point to bring up. Is 'cause even whenever you go back, and let's take it back just a couple of centuries from there, you know, the writing of the Bible. That is another one where things are attributed to other people, even whenever you go back to ancient philosophy, things like that. Phaedo, that kind of stuff by Plato, he made it perfectly clear that this teaching came to me through my teacher, Socrates. Like, they were really, really good at notating their sources. They never claimed things that they didn't come up with. That was anathema. You just didn't do that. If it came to you through your teacher, you notated your teacher. So, yeah. Why is there no notation? Why is there no thank you to my mentor? anything like that in any of his works. No dedication.
And I mentioned the first printed work with the name William Shakespeare on it was this beautiful poem called Venus and Adonis. Mm. And it was dedicated to one of the most glittering aristocrats in Queen Elizabeth's court, and he was the third Earl of Southampton. He dedicated the work to him, kind of betraying kind of a closeness between them. But there's no known connection between him and the Stratford man. Zero. So where, you know, how did he come out of nowhere and get these incredible connections? And that's problematic. And when you add up all these mysteries and zeros, it all points to it being a pen name, and the pen name of a nobleman. And a nobility back then, if they were involved in plays or creative writing, poetry, that was considered something frivolous. It wasn't something you would want to be known.
Yeah.
So writing anonymously or using a pen name was just really normal during this period.
Well, not only that, but especially if these works were not commissioned by the royal family to be mentioning, poking fun at the royal family in the way that they do, to be poking fun at any royal families, to be going into like, hey, you know, those crazy Danes over there, they were so crazy, they saw ghosts in their house. Like we said, pretty anathema. It would not have happened. That's how you lose a hand. That's how you get yourself called Stubbs for the rest of your life. Even if you were close to the court, didn't matter. Like, you could have been second cousin to Queen Elizabeth. If you wrote a play like that about her, good luck, buddy.
That's right. Or people, if people knew that you were close to her, they would read into what you write to say, oh,
yeah,
is there any reference here to the queen? Is there any reference to her ministers? You know, and that's exactly what was going on, like in a play like Twelfth Night.
Oh, precisely. Precisely.
The queen was probably represented as Olivia, who was the noblewoman, and then sort of her steward was, many believe was a lampooning of Sir Christopher Hatton, who was one of her ministers. So, and he wasn't really portrayed, he was portrayed more in a comical way. So again, this may have been funny to the queen, but maybe not funny to other people. So, you know, when you lampoon people, you may, you know, irritate them as well. So,
precisely. And as we said, not a protected society, not a society with laws assuring the fact that you had right to do that.
Yeah, and what my book does in Shakespeare Suppressed, one chapter I go over what contemporaries wrote about Shakespeare. They didn't say they knew him, but they dropped little clues about him, and if you. The inferences are that he was somebody who was a man of rank, that he was writing anonymously, that he was a patron, a generous patron. He was well known to university students. And one hinted that he was dead in 1605. The Stratford man died in 1616. So you have to look at what contemporaries were writing. You have to do a little digging in them.
Yeah.
Because they were using allegory in this. So that, by not being open about it, means there was something secretive about this person, right? And also, they had to be a little bit careful of what they said. And that indicates he was maybe someone of rank.
Yeah.
So there are clues out there, but you just won't find them in your average Shakespeare biography. You're just going to find a whole nother. In some cases, more fiction than fact.
Well, precisely. These are not things that you're going to hear junior year of high school when you were reading Romeo and Juliet. They are not things that you're going to hear in your typical Shakespeare class or theater class, anything like that focuses on him.
It's a topic they ignore. English professors don't want to talk about this. They're happy with the status quo. for now, whatever reason.
And that's interesting. Let's get into that for a minute, because one thing that we did not do at the beginning, which I am prone to do, especially with folks like you, Catherine, how did you get into this to begin with? Like, how did you come into this realm of research?
Well, my high school English teacher mentioned that some people think Shakespeare was Marlowe. And that's all she said, just one tiny comment, and that stuck in my brain. And then not too long afterwards, a couple years later, when I was in college, I saw a debate on television, and I remembered what she said. And this was a debate on the authorship question. And so they had on one end a Shakespeare professor from I believe Princeton, a very high, university, and renowned university. And then he was debating a man named Charlton Ogburn. He was a Harvard graduate and a well-known author. And they were debating who was the great author, the man from Stratford or the Earl of Oxford. And I knew nothing about this. I was a history major at UCLA. So I was looking at it from an evidence point of view, and I can see that Charlton Ogburn made so many good points and logical statements, and the professor, really, all he could do, he couldn't support his man. All he can do was pretty much belittle the topic. So, of course, then I read Charlton Ogburn's book, and from that point on, I was just, like, electrified. I wanted to learn more, and I wanted to tell people about it.
Yeah.
So
just couldn't not dig rabbit holes from that point on.
No.
Yeah, and I'm the same way. When I find something, I chase it doggedly, and I can't not do it. Like, I've got to at least know something and figure it out.
Yes.
And
it's been more than 30 years, and it's still, to me, the most incredible topic I've ever come across.
Well, and I think what's really interesting, like you said, is this attachment that English teachers, theater teachers have, that they are not willing to let go or even admit. And it reminds me a lot of whenever we have people in fringe sciences, things like that on. And hey, you're like, Even people like our guest a couple weeks ago, Terry Lovelace, Esquire, like, he was a lawyer. There's a reason why he did not come forward with his UFO witness statement years before. He was a practicing lawyer. He could have been chased out of town going and practicing law and saying that he saw a UFO. Okay, crazy man. So whenever you're talking about fringe sciences, things like that, yes, it can't. I even recently had an anthropology professor from UT right here in my own backyard say he would prefer not to come on my show. because he thought that his opinions on the Mayans and mound builders of North America may not be popular with my guests or with my audience. And I was like, well, what's funny is most of the time we are demystifying things. Like we are here. We aren't trying to go down a conspiracy rabbit hole. We're trying to fight that concept and trying to bring actual fact-based stuff in. And I just watched your series, and it was amazing. Like, I'm pretty sure if I enjoyed it, my audience will. But at the end, I told him, I also firmly understand your reticence. All it takes is one donor to see that you appeared on a show named Dudes and Beer that talks about UFOs, talks about other wild things like Shakespeare controversies, and you went on there to talk about actual Mayan history. There are some donors who may not like that and may pull funding from a grant. And that's how silly it gets. That's how crazy it gets, which is odd to me because in a realm of science, it's one of those, aren't you supposed to treat every question as though it's valid?
Right. But the whole point of science is more evidence comes up.
Yes.
And you change your theory.
That's right.
And that's what's happened with the Shakespeare controversy.
Precisely.
There's been more and more evidence pointing away from the person born in Stratford-on-Avon and toward the Earl of Oxford. And unfortunately, academics, they don't want to be part of it.
Well, and that's just it. It's really strange because it's not like, and it's literature, don't get me wrong. It's history, it's world history. I mean, history is written by the victors, you know? It's strange because we have the religion of science that we talk about on this show all the time where, whole branches of science could disappear, like, with some of the new discoveries. Like, it's out there. It's wild. But this is literature. What's that going to do?
Exactly.
Like, what's that going to do?
Exactly.
So, okay, well, so maybe your thesis might have to be amended.
Right. And that's what all good scientists do.
But
when
granted,
they get new evidence and they test it try it.
Even as an English major or English professor or somebody who has made their living studying the works of William Shakespeare, that does not dissolve your work. That does not dissolve your analysis of the work or anything like that. All that's happened is that through forensic research, we have found out that that man is not that man. Wouldn't we let him out of prison?
Like, exactly.
Like, if this was a court case, wouldn't you be like, well, yeah, maybe that dude deserves a few years of his life back?
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, the thing is, we're reading the plays and poems, like, only in black and white.
Yeah.
But when you have a real biography to put next to it, then you're going to read them in living color, and you're going to get so much more out of them. And that's one of my missions, you know, and for writing my book and get being on shows like yours to get the word out.
And
they're going to have a whole different experience and a much more enjoyable.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just it. Like, that's why we have people like you on this show, is because it's so important to have the conversation. Even if it is I don't care if it is over a beer and you're just having a conversation. It's important to bang those things around in the world. It's important to throw things against the wall and see what sticks.
And, you know, we're not just talking about any old writer. I mean, he's considered one of the greatest writers of the English language. We speak his language every day. He coined over 2,000 words for the English language, and many phrases we say, like foregone conclusion, you know, that's a Shakespeare phrase.
Yeah.
You don't know it, but you're saying it. So he's hugely influential in our lives, and we should know who he was, if not only just to illuminate the works, but to have a better understanding of genius.
Well, Yeah, precisely.
That it does take a lot of saturation of knowledge in the beginning by tutors and things like that. And that's exactly what the Earl of Oxford had. He had private tutors. And by the age of 13 or 14, these tutors told them that they were finished teaching him. He knew everything at that point. And he went to Cambridge when he was 8 years old. He went to Oxford when he was 12, you know. And he went to law school. Then a few years later, he took a grand tour of Europe for a year and a half. All of these are shown in the Shakespeare plays. They come out.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and especially whenever you look at something along the lines of Romeo and Juliet, because that is not exactly something that, you know, Verona is a pretty out of the way little town in Italy. Like, even to know that it existed on a map, would that have been a casual person's knowledge?
I don't think so.
That's like asking somebody on an unassisted map to go, hey, man, show me Poughkeepsie.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, good luck pointing it out without it being written on the map. So to think that somebody who was not of educated ilk was not of these rungs of society, was not of somebody who would be familiar with smaller ruling class towns such as Verona.
Yes, and Romeo and Juliet is an excellent example, because in the first act, somebody says, "Where's Romeo?" And they say, "Oh, he's near in the sycamore grove at the western wall." Okay, now that, and where this is Verona, right? And
yeah.
So that's a very specific detail, and has nothing to do with what based on the story, the 14th century story, has nothing to do with sycamore trees, right? It was just a detail that was thrown in there.
Sure.
Well, one of our people who are into this topic wrote a beautiful book. His name is Richard Rowe. It's called The Shakespeare Guide to Italy. And he went to Italy and to seek out if these little details that Shakespeare just kind of drops here and there in the plays actually were real. And one of them was sycamore trees at the western, which are still there to this day.
Wow. Wow. Absolutely. And it's not like, you know, that'd be one of those random things that you just go at. Well, I don't know. Maybe somebody at some point in Verona was like, you know what we should do? Because Romeo and Juliet is such a popular story. We should plant a grove of sycamore trees over by our western wall, like it says in there. and
right.
I love the fact
right.
that you laugh, because, yeah, that's exactly how ridiculous that sounds, people. It sounds as ridiculous as that idea is. That's the
yeah.
idea here, is that, yeah, nobody had a town meeting and was like, I propose this. Pretty doubtful, you know? And like we were saying, for somebody to have such intimate knowledge of, hey, even just a city that small, that far away, like literally on another countries and countries away. You could not get further away from England than Italy when it comes to Europe. It is the direct
yes,
opposite
yes.
direction.
And how can the professor account for it? He just shrugs his shoulder and says, oh, you know, it's genius, the mystery of genius.
That's right. That's
but
right. And
some things are not covered in the mystery of genius. Some things you need to experience and be there.
Well,
and Rowe's book tells you 100% that he was there in Italy, and there's no accounting for the Stratford man leaving the country. I mean,
wow.
you needed permission to leave the country back then, so
there's
nothing indicating that
well,
for the Stratford man. It's a big blank for him.
Well,
I'm
let's...
sorry. And it's not his fault, you
no.
see. That's
He's
what
just
I try
caught
to point
up in
out.
History, man.
It was arranged after the Earl of Oxford died and after he died. Somebody arranged it to confuse the person with the similar name to the pen name with the great author.
Oh, my God.
And that's what happened. And it was so good, it's lasted 400 years now.
I am
and
trying
actually
to remember.
The origin of this whole mystery was in 1623, and the 400th anniversary is coming up, actually, for that.
Wow.
And it was the publication of a book called Mr. William Shakespeare's Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies. And we call that today the first folio, because it's a large-sized book, a folio page book. And that book has 36 Shakespeare plays in it. And the opening pages, the prefatory pages, kind of hint that the great author was the Stratford man. They don't say openly, but they drop clues, like one author writes a verse to Shakespeare and mentions Stratford Monument. And another tribute to Shakespeare, they mention Sweet Swan of Avon.
Mm.
So you put those two together and you can come up with the idea that, oh, Shakespeare was from Stratford on Avon.
Yeah.
So pretty much that was the genesis of the whole thing. And people haven't looked back ever since.
Well, and it reminded me just a minute ago, while you were telling that story, of a movie that came out all of a few years ago that is based loosely around this work. And it just ran through my head. Like, I saw this entire story arc that now I have to have my wife write, of a guy who is being attributed all these works and really wants nothing to do with it. Like,
yes.
Hey, man, I didn't write that. Leave me alone. Oh, my God, your work was so amazing. Like, I didn't do that. leave me alone, throngs of people. So let's get a little bit more, because we've only got you for another few minutes, I know, today. For the last couple minutes, let's get, I guess, into the world of William Shakespeare at that time, whether it was Edward de Vere or whether it was the Man from Avon. Let's kind of climb into the driver's seat, I guess, of the playwright at that time and what their fanfare was, you know, because I think that, like we were saying earlier, that kind of stuff is really important to narratives like this, what their place was in society, all that kind of stuff, because
most of the playwrights of the period were university men, like Robert Greene and John Lilly and Thomas Nash. They were playwrights, and they had education. A few of them didn't, but the ones who were of higher status, like the Earl of Oxford, they didn't own up to it. And if you published your works, if your works were published while you were alive, that really would have been a downer. It would have hurt your reputation.
Oh, wow, really?
Yes, that's for higher ranked people. So they're like, there are people like Fulke Greville. He was a higher ranked person, and he wrote plays but didn't publish them. It didn't happen until after he died. That was the norm. And once you died, you could put your name on them, and there'd be no problem. But you couldn't put your name on them while you were alive. So that's part of the reason why the Earl of Oxford didn't get credit. He didn't want credit in his lifetime.
Oh, but sure.
He should have expected the credit after his death, and that's the problem. That's the thing that we have to solve and say, why didn't he get the credit after his death?
I think it's a really interesting thing to note about that time period in history, that it wasn't a fanfare type situation. It wasn't like there were throngs of people chasing you down the road like you were Tom Clancy that just showed up at a book signing, you know, or the person that wrote Eat, Pray, Love, something along those lines. They were, like you said, they were not out making the press run, you know. Like, hey, yeah, just wrote a new play. Here's what it's about. John, let's take a look.
Right. Well, I mean, if you were not a person of rank, having your plays printed was okay, and making money was okay. But you can't make money and be a gentleman.
No.
At the same time.
Not that kind of money.
That's the separation.
You could be wheeling and dealing in big land deals. You could be doing all kinds of things that your family did for years and years. But like you said, to pursue what would have been seen at that point as a hobby?
Yes, or something even frivolous.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And to say, like, I'm a playwright, like, okay, that's pretty frivolous. I thought you had a much higher place in society.
Right. But good poets were praised in their time, and especially when they died, like Edmund Spenser, he wrote The Faery Queen. Mm. And when he died, many people noted it in letters. We have surviving letters. They have an account of his funeral, things like that. There was tributes written to him after he died. When Ben Jonson, who was a playwright, when he died, there are a couple books full of tributes to him. But when the Stratford man died, there was not a word. The same is true for the Earl of Oxford, which is, you know, an anomaly. There should have been praise after he died. So that's, again, a problem. But it makes sense with this whole mystery surrounding him and being the author of the Shakespeare plays. It kind of fits.
Yeah.
And that's what I get into my book, the last two chapters of Shakespeare Suppressed. So.
And I cannot wait to get that far in the book, Catherine. It's like just sitting here and talking about this is mind-numbing. Mind-numbing as somebody who, like you said, we are taught to revere the works of William Shakespeare. It's almost like you found out like David Hasselhoff wrote Star Wars.
Yeah. You know? That's a very good example.
Like,
yeah.
Like, whoa, wait a minute. David Hasselhoff did not write Star Wars. Well, let's back it up a minute. Because, yeah, it's strange. And whenever you bring it up, like I said, I am surrounded by theater majors as friends. And anytime I would bring this up, it'd be like, yeah, right. Even whenever I first spoke with our mutual friend, Mark. Thank you so much, Mark Eddy. For everything that you have done for bringing guests like this to this show.
Thanks, Mark.
And connecting us. But whenever I first spoke with him about you, I was in Arizona for a friend's wedding. His ex-wife, my wife and I had gone out to meet him. As I said, my wife was a theater major at this university. Very straight-laced place. Very, very Shakespearean in its teaching of theater. Things like that. My friend's ex-wife was an English major at this university. And when I brought up even just the concept that the Earl of Oxford may have wrote some of the stuff, oh, man, the things that started coming out of mouths.
Yeah.
Like the almost, and I'm not going to say like venomous attack, but it was one of those like, really, really? Like, are we going to have this conversation? And it's like, yeah, yeah, we are. We really are. Because it's got to be looked at. We at least need to be willing to look at it.
Yes, and it's just, it's such an interesting question the deeper you delve. And for me, it's also the concept of injustice.
Yeah.
You have somebody who wrote the greatest works, plays ever, and he's not getting credit for them.
Well,
and that's not right.
And the thing that we have to remember here, folks, is it's not like we just found out that, you know, Prince didn't write his music and maybe his family won't be getting his royalties. That's not the case. Nobody's getting royalties down the line from the works of William Shakespeare. Nothing like that. Now, granted, there may be some people who claim a bloodline to the Avon man. Maybe they might be a little ilked by it, but is it something that would be an utter rewriting of history if it happened? Would it be something of recall all textbooks and change the way we teach something? No, not really. It would.
Well, it would in some
respects. Some rights, I guess.
It would in the literature sense. It
sure.
Would overturn the concept of who was copying who. Now, because the professor believes in the Stratford man's timeline, he has to go by that. So when you see lines in Shakespeare that are echoed in other people's works, you have to say, oh, Shakespeare stole from him. But if you correct the timeline, Earl of Oxford was 15 years older than the Stratford man.
Hmm.
He was the originator of all these people that they were copying. They were copying him. And there's many. In fact, the appendix of my book, I have 93, quote-unquote, too early allusions to Shakespeare. The professors won't accept these as allusions to Shakespeare because they don't fit the timeline.
Hmm.
And since then, I've compiled, I have like 700 now. So
wow.
He was a major, major influence of other writers during this period. And, he was not somebody who was stealing from others. Absolutely not.
Well, and like we said earlier in the show, it was extraordinarily rare for authors and for thinkers, playwrights, anything like that, not to give credit to their mentor. You know?
Right. Yes.
And the fact that there is, amongst all the writings of William Shakespeare, nary a mention of a mentor. You know, nary
zero,
a mention,
zero mention.
Of,
yeah.
You know, help along the way, anything like that. So,
Just
right. In fact, all the indications show that his parents were illiterate, and also his children were illiterate. So that, again, that just doesn't square with what you would expect, you know, an author writing. He had two daughters who survived him, who wrote wonderful heroines who were very literate. It just doesn't make sense.
Wow.
And we didn't even talk about the sonnets, which were...
If you have time, let's please.
Well, I just wanted to maybe just leave your listeners with, you know, the sonnets. They were 14-line poems, and Shakespeare wrote 154 of them, and they're intensely personal, talking about the loves in his life, right? And he's addressing the fair youth in one of them, sonnet 81, and he says, "From hence your memory death cannot take, although in me each part will be forgotten. Your name," meaning the fair youth, "your name from hence immortal life shall have, though I once gone to all the world must die." So this shows that he knew he would not get credit for the works. He knew that the fair youth's name will live forever, and the fair youth was the Earl of Southampton who Shakespeare dedicated two works to. So his name forever will be associated with those works, and those works will live forever. But William Shakespeare's name will not live forever, too? Why not?
Yeah.
Because it was a pen name.
Yep.
So.
Wow.
And you can go as late as 1640, somebody said, "Shakespeare, we must be silent in thy praise." Why?
Yeah.
Why do we need to be in 1640?
After his death.
Shakespeare had been dead supposedly for 30 years. So these are anomalies and mysteries and things like that, which all make sense if we were talking about someone's pen name.
If you were talking...
Someone of high rank.
Yeah, exactly. Someone of...
It fits. Yeah.
Wow. And like I said, the information provided in Shakespeare Suppressed, the information that you guys put out on Shakespeare Authorship Coalition, things like that, absolutely amazing. And the fact that y'all are doggedly chasing this, I am so happy for. Because, like I said, it's not... yes, it may shake the worlds of literature. It may change a couple of textbooks, but it's not like we're saying, you know, it's not like we're reversing the last 500 years of history fully and saying, no, really, the earth is flat. We thought it was round, but it's not. Because it was only the last 500 years or so that we unanimously as a globe decided the world is round. Until then, if you sailed to the edge, you were going to fall off, and to say otherwise was anathema. You could be burned at the stake, excommunicated, kicked out of your village for devilry, all kinds of stuff. And it's only in the very last short span of human history that we have all conjecturally decided, no, it's not. Science tells us it's round. And like I said earlier, were this a court case, you would have a hard time proving the fact that the man from Avon is William Shakespeare.
Yes, in fact, the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition put out a £40,000 reward to the bastion of Shakespeare scholarship. It's called the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. This is in England. And, you know, they say, put your case before impartial judges, you know, and we'll make the arrangements, whatever, and prove that the Stratford man wrote the works, and we'll give you a £40,000 reward or donation. And they didn't take it up at all.
Wow.
I mean, if they're so confident, why wouldn't they do it?
Yeah. Why wouldn't you take a £40,000 donation?
I mean, they're a registered charity, so in a way, they're required to.
We've said we will give you this money if you do this.
Yeah. So it's very odd, and
wow.
and everybody is losing. They're losing it as a researcher or a Shakespeare professor, and we're loser as readers and
yeah.
and fans of Shakespeare. So that's kind of why I'm.
Just
I do
as
this.
Students of history and people in the world around us, you know. You can't go around attributing things to people that it ain't.
And the Earl of Oxford had such an incredible life. I mean, there should be a one-hour drama for each year of his life. I mean, it's incredible, and it's so interesting.
Yeah.
And yet people are being separated from it. You know?
It's absolutely amazing. And like I said, you are not on your own in this venture. There are other people working with you at doubtaboutwill.org with the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition. There are other people working with you, other fantastic researchers.
Yes, and the Shakespeare Shakespeare Fellowship.
Mm.
Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. Sorry, that's another great organization. Put out a newsletter, and a great magazine called The Oxfordian. So, I really encourage people who have some interest in this to check it out.
Yeah, most definitely. I think anybody who is interested in Shakespeare should check it out. That's opens the gate to a whole lot more people, I think, because it really should be one of those, like, you should follow this rabbit hole just to see if it is, you know, just to see if it's something. If anything, folks, do it just to see if it's something that if you were sitting in a jury box, would you convict? You know, because we really do have to, as a society, and we talk about this all the time on the show, we have to start looking at points of datum dispassionately. We have to get back to that, to not look at datum, literally just a raw piece of data, as nothing more than that. To look at it as something of, just because I don't agree with it, it destroys my paradigm, so I will not look at it. I will not consider it. That is no longer an option in our society, I don't think. We have to be willing to examine. We have to be willing to dig deeper. We have to be willing to scratch beyond the surface of what we have known as people. And this really does come down to where we are as a society. And if we aren't willing to just peel back that one more layer of the onion, you know, to get to the good stuff underneath, we're doing ourselves the disservice.
This controversy is really evidence-based. You just have to look at the evidence, and that's why so many lawyers are involved in our movement. And actually, Supreme Court justices have given their opinion on this.
Wow.
And several of them see a problem. And, for example, I think the late Ginsburg, she thought it may have been another writer, John Florio. The point is, she doubted the Stratford man.
Yeah.
And that's all we need to do. Once you have doubt about him, then there's a whole opening as to who he really was. It'll lead you to who he really was.
Wow. And it's such powerful, such amazing information that you lay down in the book Shakespeare Suppressed. I want to personally thank you for sending me a copy of it. It's not too often that I not only get books and materials from authors, but actual handwritten thank you notes, things like that. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For that. It really does mean the world to me as a show host whenever people take the time to do such. And I have thoroughly enjoyed reading the first part of this. I cannot wait to get more into it. I cannot. You know what we need to make sure to do, Catherine, is to have you on for Shakespeare's birthday.
Oh, I'd love it.
Let's revisit this topic coming up in April, correct?
Yes. April 23rd is the traditional Shakespeare birthday.
That's it. I knew it was right up around there. I wasn't going to go any further than April. I was willing to make myself look fool enough with that one. So, thank you so much. Before we let you go, please do one more time tell everybody where they can go to find the book other than the Dudes and Beer store, because we have, of course, as always, added our guest book to the Dudes and Beer store. Dudesandbeer.com/store is where you can find that. Tell everybody where they can go to find your websites, where else they can go to order your book, where they can go to maybe get involved with the search and maybe start doing a little bit of research that they can contribute.
Read the introduction to my book and see the table of contents is shakespearesuppressed.com. And you can also get it, you can write me. There's a contact form. You can write me if you have any questions. And also you can buy the book on Amazon. So it's regularly on Amazon. So, and I would encourage people to go to the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship site and the Doubt About Will site and read the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt and maybe put your signature to it.
The stuff in this book is so phenomenal. Literally the last, 30 pages, 40 pages is nothing but notes, nothing but pictures. Absolutely phenomenal. So to know that there are good people like you out there doing this research, that there are people like you carrying on this quest for truth and such things.
And it's wonderful there are people like you who knew about the topic and were so great to bring me on and talk.
Any time. Topics like this are so fun and so near and dear to my heart because, I'm a theater geek. Like, that's what got me into the world that I live in now, which is tech. Like, that's what brought me into my career path and into my passion was theater. So whenever I hear about things like this, Wow, it's phenomenal to know that an entire field could be turned on its side. Turned on its side is the easiest way to put it.
I think we're on the verge of that. I hope we are.
Well, we will definitely be here anytime you have revelations, new information, new things coming out that you want to promote. Feel free to drop a line, Catherine. My airwaves are yours. You are welcome on this show with this information anytime.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line while we close things out with our audience real quick. Many, many thanks to our good friends over at WMLD in the Poughkeepsie area, over in the Hudson Valley, for always carrying Dudes and Beer. You can check us out there on Wednesdays and Sunday replay. As well as we will be coming out on an online radio station out of Las Vegas coming up. So all kinds of fun stuff, all kinds of great announcements. Make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com to get your copy of the book. You can also find it on Amazon. You can also get it through Catherine's websites. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, if you can't be good at it. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.